Okay, if you'll open your notebooks to page 41, and then Daniel chapter 1 in your Bibles. I have one copy left if anyone would like it for class. I'd be happy to bring it to you if you need it. Thank you. All right. This particular story that we began last Sunday, there was no class, of course, because of our singing this past Wednesday. So we're looking at the three chapters in Daniel. Chapter 1 we use as just as a backdrop, preparation stage, if you will, for why the four Hebrews that we're looking at in these two, or in this lesson, were able to do what they did in chapters 3 and 6. And we didn't get very far in chapter 1, but we noticed that these were the ones who were removed, taken captive by Nebuchadnezzar, and they were going to be loyal to God. They were put under immense pressure or challenges in the first chapter here about entering into Nebuchadnezzar's service. We looked at some important dates. Nineveh fell to Babylon in 612, so that was the end pretty much of the Assyrian Empire, and Babylon was now the world dominating force, if you will, kingdom. And Babylon defeats Egypt at Carchemish, and Nebuchadnezzar chases Pharaoh Necho all the way through Jordan, or through Judah, and he learns there that his father has died, so he must rush back to the capital to reclaim the throne, and he takes captives with him. And this is the date that we've chosen. I think it fits well when the events of Daniel chapter 1 take place. 606, 605 BC, when these young men are taken back to Chaldea or Babylon. And we then pick up these events here in chapter 1 where they're realized, the forces that be, if you will, Nebuchadnezzar and his officials realize that we've taken all these captives, not just Judean captives, but all the nations that they've conquered. Again, they're not going to waste good talent. They're going to look and see young men that show promise potential, as we see listed here in verses 3 and 4. And they're going to try to make them Chaldean, train them for a certain period of time. That would be for 3 years, as is stated in verse 5. And then they would be put into the king's personal service into his court. So he besieges Jerusalem and takes Hebrews captive, deports them. And he tells the official, we want good-looking youths, those who have no defects. They're not lame or maimed in any way. They're healthy. They show good intelligence, potential. You'll see there in verse 4, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving in the king's court. And they were then going to be instructed or trained in certain ways. And this is where we pick up this morning. The goal is to make them Chaldean. That's the goal. And in verses 4 through 7, look the way that they're going to train them. They're going to, first of all, they're going to teach them the Chaldean language and literature. So they won't speak Hebrew anymore. They're going to speak the tongue of the Chaldeans. They're going to feed them Chaldean food off the king's table. Get used to that regimen or that diet. And also, they're going to give them Chaldean names. And we have, particularly in this chapter, these four. Usually we say Daniel, then we use the three Chaldean names. But the four Hebrew names, it was Daniel, then Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. There's the four. But we're going to change their names. Daniel was called what with his new name? Belteshazzar, and then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And you can imagine what would have been the Hebrew names had a meaning. Usually they were, many Hebrew names were attributed to some praise of Jehovah, some praise of God. And then what about pagan names? Well, they would reflect the pagan gods. And you can do a little research and find out what the three names of, or the four names of these Hebrew youths were going to reflect or what they were going to point towards. So, The goal is to make them Chaldean. And at the end of 3 years, when they have done all this stuff, all these things, Then they would be placed into, if they pass all their training, they would be placed into Nebuchadnezzar's personal service, and then they sort of have a job. And that would be their future. Now that's what they're faced with. That's what they're being, are they being asked to do this or told to do it? Well, there's no asking. They're captives. They don't have any rights. You do this and that's just the way that is. Would be sort of the right way to think about that. Now, what I'm asking in question two, this is just a thought question outside the text, but I think this is worthy to consider. You're one of these, what I'm calling an enterprising young man that's described in verses 3 and 4. Whether you're from Judah, whether you're one of the Israelites, or whether you're from one of the other nations that Babylon has captured. They were taking captives from everybody as they marched toward world domination. All right. So somebody from Nebuchadnezzar's administration comes along and picks you. They realize, well, you're good looking, you have no defects, you show intelligence, you seem like a pretty bright person. We think we can use you. We're gonna train you and school you, all right, teach you some new things, kind of make you into a certain kind of person that we want. And at the end of your training, I'm telling you what, you're gonna have a great job. You're gonna serve Nebuchadnezzar himself in his court. Now if you're one of these aspiring young men that, you know, kind of want to have a good place in the world, kind of want to get ahead, how might you think about that offer, just off the top of your head? Absolutely. This, what an opportunity. I mean, this isn't just some little rogue king we're serving. This is Nebuchadnezzar himself. So, whatever they're going to ask me to do, I mean, that's what I'm going to do. I don't think that's that far-fetched. I think that sort of thing actually happened. Greg and I were talking after class last Sunday, and what I first thought about would be, as the question states, how might most enterprising young captives from other nations? But do you suppose that there might have been some Hebrew captives who weren't as dedicated as these four who went along with this? I bet there was. And see, the problem that sometimes we see among the Lord's people today, having too much world in us, having too much desire to be like those around us in the world, not being transformed but being conformed, I doubt that's a modern-day problem. I would imagine they faced some of the same challenges back then. Not being true to God, not being as faithful as a Hebrew needed to be to the law of Moses. And so I don't have any proof of this, but it would not surprise me. I would not be surprised if there were some young Hebrews who were taken captive along with these four who went along with this just to have this opportunity, if you will, if we're going to call it that, to serve this mighty king in his court. So what an opportunity. You know, sometimes to get ahead, you've got to go along. I mean, that's just the way the game is played in the world. How many have ever been asked to do something on your job by some boss or some superior, and they want you to do something and you in good conscience can't do that because in your mind there's some conflict between doing that and serving Christ, but the boss or the president or the owner of the business says, now if you do this, I'm not going to forget you. Well, what's that tell you in that kind of statement, you say, I'm not going to forget you? What's that usually mean or refer to? And later, I'll take care of you later. You help me right now and I'll take care of you later. That was told me one time when I was working in the banking business and the president called me down to his office one morning. I mean, see the president, that's pretty high up there. And he had a proposal for me. He wanted me to help him do something. And he said, and he knew I wanted off the teller line. That was the bottom of the barrel there. And he said, now, if you do this, I won't forget it. I tell you what, I felt pressured. I wanted a promotion. But I couldn't do what he wanted me to do. Not in good conscience. So here are these young men. And these four Hebrews that we're studying here, they knew they were under this pressure, this challenge. And we're going to be impressed, hopefully, with the stand that they take because it was the right thing to do. So, in the absence of moral convictions, how would a worldly person respond to such an offer, usually? They have no convictions, and so they're going to do it. Absolutely. You'd be a fool to pass up this opportunity. But when you throw convictions in the mix, when you throw loyalty to God in the mix, see, that changes everything. It's not the same game anymore. There's something at work that's a lot more important than getting a promotion or getting ahead in the world, so to speak. And that's what Daniel and these four, or these other three used, these four together, had to consider. So it was not an easy decision in that well, we'll just do it to get the promotion. So their convictions would not allow this. I want you to look at the first part of verse 8. The New King James, I believe, says, and the Old King James also, if I'm not mistaken, that Daniel purposed in his heart. Other versions say, this one says, Daniel made up his mind. All right. So the heart and the mind is the same thing. The biblical heart is not, of course, the blood-pumping muscle in your chest. It's the mind. It's the eye. It's the heart. All those things are synonymous. Daniel made up his mind. Can young people make up their minds to do what God wants to do? God wants them to do. Yes, they can. Sometimes I think we're guilty, and I'm using we in a very broad way, and I don't mean to indict everybody with that, but sometimes I think some of us that are older, we sell some of our young people a little short, and we don't realize that they have strong convictions. And here were four young people. Here were four young people that said, we can't do this. This is just not... It's our faith and our loyalty to God is not going to allow us to do this. And that's got to be impressive. I want that to impress us a whole lot. Now, even though Daniel's name is only mentioned in verse 8, it doesn't say that they made up their minds. It says Daniel made up his mind. We know it wasn't just Daniel. Look at all the other references, at least in verses 10 through 20. Particularly, verse 10, when the commander is responding first to Daniel's request not to eat off the table, he said, why should the king see your faces, plural, just you four, not just you, but all four of you, why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the rest? And also look in verse 12, Daniel's request, the second time around, he didn't say, please let thy servant be tested for 10 days. Give me only water and vegetables. He said, let your servants be tested. Give us water. So it was all four of them. It wasn't just Daniel. These four were in this together. Well, let's not forget the other three are in this with Daniel just as much as he is. The heart was purposed. The mind was made up. And when a child of God makes up his mind or her mind, all right, to serve God, to be loyal, then what can he or she do? Under immense pressure. You can do anything. The mind's made up. What if the challenge gets really, really hard? Well, that can happen. But once the mind is... See, what's the first order of business? You've got to make up your mind. What if the mind's never made up? Then how much good will you do for God if you don't make up your mind? You won't do anything. More than likely, you'll cave into this pressure. And you'll go along with the world. And you'll do the things that the world wants you to do. Things that would displease God. But the mind must first be made up. That's the first order of business. So to me, the critical, the most telling statement in the first chapter is the first part of verse 8, where it says that Daniel made up his mind, or he purposed in his heart, that he would not defile himself. That's where it starts right there. Now, the concern, he says, he does not want to defile himself. And I've asked you in question, second part of question 3, What was this business of being defiled? What did that involve? How would he have been defiled? It's really how I'm going with it in this question. All right, I'm convinced, Larry, I think makes the right statement. I would suppose, and I'm pretty convinced of this, at least in my mind, to eat off the king's table, if that was going to defile him, I think it had to have something to do with the law of clean and unclean foods that a Hebrew had to be concerned about. And you can read about that in Leviticus chapter 11, Deuteronomy chapter 14. We won't go to those passages, but there's some quite lengthy reading there, all right? In terms of what the Hebrew or the Jew could eat, what God said you can't eat, it's clean, it's all right, versus what you can eat. That's off limits. Now, Obviously, Nebuchadnezzar would have no concern for that at all. I mean, he's the king. The kings eat like kings do. And so, you know, that's what we're going to eat. And I want you all to eat off my table. What an honor to eat off my table. But Daniel is thinking, I can't do that. There's something else here at play that's more concern to me than eating off the king's table. So I think that was the concern that they had, this business of being defiled. So, Daniel's first response. What does he say when he's made up his mind? Now, that's internal. That's just with Daniel and these other three. They haven't said anything yet to anybody, but they've already made the decision. I don't know how this is going to work out. I don't know how how we can go about getting this done, but our minds are already made up now. Whatever's going to have to happen is going to have to happen, but we're not going to defile ourselves. So what was his first request? What was his first response? Look at the last part of verse 8. All right, it was just a simple request. Yes, we don't want to defile ourselves. Now, we don't know much about that in terms of how that was going to get worked out. Notice that Daniel did not say, well, now, you can't make me eat that. I'm telling you what, that's not going to happen. Now, he didn't rebel. Remember, he's a captive. He's a slave. And he doesn't have a seat at the bargaining table. He doesn't get to negotiate here. He didn't have that. He didn't rebel. He's not an open rebel. He just simply requested, can we be excused from this? And no other details are given. We don't know how that was going to work itself out, if that request had been granted. That's just his request. He just respectfully... I see Daniel and these are the three as four respectful young Hebrews, and they just request. We just would rather not do this. We have some convictions about this, some concerns about it, and we just would rather not. Well, how was that met with response from the Chaldean official? In this place we see is someone called the commander there in verse 9. God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. And he'll be the first one to respond to this simple request from Daniel and the other three. So what was his response? That's right. He says, well, I'll tell you what, here's what I think about that. He said, if you don't eat this, you're going to look a lot worse than everybody else that does eat it. Because that's what we eat around here anyway, and you're getting to eat off the best place. And if you're going to look kind of puny and pitiful about this, then when the king sees you, no doubt he's going to ask some questions. Okay, how come these four over here don't look like everybody else does? And it's going to come out, and who's going to get the blame for it? He said, I'm not going to lose my head just because you've got some concerns about this. See, typical worldly response. Child of God makes a request based on a principle of conviction. The commander says, I don't really care about your convictions. That's not my concern. My concern is you doing what you're told and me keeping my job in my own head. So in a word, what was the answer? No. That's really it. No, you're going to eat it. That's just how that goes. So the king is not going to be pleased, and I'm not going to lose my head because you have these convictions. Well, besides their captives with no rights, they just need to do what they're told. I mean, that's really their position. Now, some would say right at this juncture, well, all right, I'm Daniel, or I'm the other three, the four of us, and we've asked, and we got told. So I guess we better do it. Is that what Daniel did? No. He didn't quit. Who did he go to next? Did he go to somebody else? Who did he go to? Was it someone else? All right. Look at verse 11. But Daniel said to the overseer whom the commander had appointed. So he went to someone else in this chain of command. He spoke to the commander, and the way I read verse 11, the commander is over the overseer. So he went one step down this ladder of this chain of command, if you will. So I'll go talk to somebody else. What I want us to be impressed with again is Daniel's resourceful. Okay? He won't take no for an answer. Because this is important. And he's made his mind up. Remember, his mind is made up. I'm going to find a way And that needs to tell us something, is that when the will of God is at stake in your personal life and you're being asked or told to do something, you've got to find a way to not violate your convictions, not violate your conscience when someone who's over you, who sort of has your grades in their hand or your job in their hand, I mean, they've got leverage on you, that can get kind of intimidating. I've heard of high school students saying things like, well, if you don't do this, I mean, I've heard of high school students say, well, you know, we've got PE class, and they make us wear shorts in PE class. And I've got some concerns about that. And so they'll go talk to a teacher and say, you know, I'll come to gym class, I'll do all the push-ups and sit-ups you want me to, I'll run the track, I'll do whatever, but I just don't want to wear these shorts. And some teachers will say, well, if you don't, I'm gonna give you an F. That's what we wear, that's our uniform, and you're going to be like everybody else. You're going to wear the uniform. I say, that's intimidating to a young person. Or maybe even not in school anymore. Maybe you're on the job like the rest of us older people out here, and the boss tells you, well, you've got to do this. Or they say, I'm sure some of you have faced this too. Sometimes a little social event is planned, office party or whatnot. And they'll come along and say, now, everybody's supposed to be there. There was one planned for when I was in the secular world, and there was going to be a drink. There was going to be an open bar there. And everybody's supposed to show up. And I wasn't going to go. I didn't want to be around that. Well, you're expected to be there. And so we'll see you there. And that's implied. And if you don't show up, there's going to be some trouble. And see, we face situations like that. These are real world situations. This isn't just hypothetical stuff, or it's not just, you know, theory. Not just some exaggeration. But the child of God can make up his mind. Well, that's expected of me, but see, what does God expect of me? What about those expectations? And I'm more concerned about pleasing him than I am about pleasing my boss, my teacher, whoever the other authority figure may be that's demanding something of me. And so Daniel is not going to quit. He's resourceful. He didn't take the first no. His second response, I made up mind I'm not going to give up. I made up mind I'm going to keep plugging away, keep going, because it's the right thing to do. So he's trying to find a way to do both. He's trying to find a way to satisfy his new authority figures, that would be the Chaldeans, but at the same time, he wants to please God too. Now, if that can't ever be done, if you've got to pick one, if it comes down to it, it's one or the other, then who does the made-up mind choose? Always. He'll choose God. That's the right choice. But Daniel hasn't given up yet on the idea that maybe I can find a way to please these people and still not violate myself before Jehovah, before God. So he goes to the overseer. He talks to someone else. And he proposes an alternative test. What does he say? What does Daniel recommend? All right, just give us 10 days. You keep feeding everybody else off the king's table and let your servants eat only what? Vegetables and drink what? Drink water. Daniel's concern is not just, we want to eat healthy. That's not it, okay? There was a concern of being defiled, of committing sin, violating the law. So just let us eat that. And he also said one more thing that I think maybe would have been the clincher in this. Because again, just proposing that test is no big deal. But he says one more thing to the overseer. Pardon? All right, test us and then at the end, do to us what you want. If that means cutting our heads off, if that means running us through with a sword, whatever, we'll be in your hands and you can deal with us any way you want to. Well, that's what he said. That's a statement of confidence. What did Daniel know? God's involved, and if I do this thing God's way, I'm not going to fail. It's going to work out. He's confident. So, the test. Test us with water and vegetables for 10 days, and then we place ourselves in your hands. This is the end of verse 13. Deal with your servants according to what you see. We'll just place ourselves in your hands. All right. Well, how did the test work out? The results of it. Verse 14. First off, the overseer had to agree to it, and he did. So he did not respond the way the commander replied. He first said, no. So that guy says, okay, that's the deal. We'll do that. And I get the idea through verses 15 and 16 that no one else knew this. Only the overseer knew that it was working out this way. Not that it was trying to be kept a secret, but maybe this just was between him and the four Hebrews, the four youths. And that's just how it was going to go. So at the end of 10 days, it came time for the test. And how did they stand up to the rest of the bunch? They looked better. They looked healthier. If someone wants to make the argument, see, eating better is better for you, well, okay, I guess I couldn't argue with that, but that's not the real concern here. But they did fare better because they were faithful to the law. And so what was the decision the overseer made at the end of the 10 days? What did he decide to do? I'm going to keep feeding them this. I mean, they're looking a lot better than the others. So they continued to eat this way. The way I understand verse 16, this was done for the duration of their training. Jump back to verse 5. How long was the training? The end of verse 5? 3 years? So I take this to mean that they were fed this way for the duration of the training, and everybody else ate off the king's table. And that's how this got worked out for Daniel and his three friends. Now, could the Hebrew eat meat? He could eat meat. Meat's not mentioned, all right, but he could eat meat. As long as it was clean food that the law would have allowed. But in terms of eating the defiling things off the king's table, that was withheld from them per Daniel's request. Okay, so at the end of this thing, also notice in verse 17, the Bible says that God gave these four. God gave them some things. God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. And Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. Now, when's that going to come into play? Well, pretty soon. Chapter 2, chapter 4, also later in the book, when Daniel has to tell him the meaning of the handwriting on the wall, the other king. So God is blessing them with this kind of wisdom while everybody else is filled with human wisdom. Just a quick point here, a quick application. God blesses us when we seek His way first. Seek ye first the kingdom of God, Jesus said, and then all these things that you have concern about, you'll have what you need. But seek God's way first. These four are seeking the way of God first. They're concerned about that. All right. Well, they come to the end of chapter 1, and here's how it all came out. Time for the king now to make his examination. They are brought before the king. What does Nebuchadnezzar notice? Now, I get the idea. He's not been aware of any of this. This is just going on all behind the scenes. And now it's time to bring in these promising youths who have been captured from other lands, and they've been trained, educated, renamed. They look probably dressed like Chaldeans now. I mean, their job was to make them Chaldeans. What did the king notice as he looked over his potential new court? These four stood out. In fact, it says in verse 19, the king talked with them, and out of them all, not one was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. They just were head and shoulders above everybody else, all the way. And so they entered the king's service. They were put into that position, and they received honor. Verse 20. It concludes, as for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, the king, you know, he always consults his advisors. Daniel writes that Nebuchadnezzar found them 10 times better than all the magicians and the conjurers, his wise men, if you will, who were from the other realms or who were already serving in his administration. So when this challenge started, what kind of position was Daniel in? When the decree was given to him, now you're going to eat off this table. He was not in a good spot. How did it work out? It worked out all right. Now, does that mean that when you put God first, that it'll always work out for you? No, it doesn't mean that. Let's not make that the lesson. There's no promises. It won't work out for you here sometimes, but really where it's important, how it'll work out for you. And in the afterwhile, it'll always work out for you if you're true and faithful. You may lose that job. You may suffer here. You may even lose your life. That may happen. But at least you'll be faithful to God and He'll reward you when it really counts. So here's the situation. Here's the backdrop. Chapter 1 that provides us, I think, for these two other chapters we'll look at here in a moment. Chapter 3 and chapter 6. So it's an application. Babylon tried to change these four Hebrews into Chaldeans. What did they do? They changed their names, they changed their diet, they changed their education, they changed their training, they changed all that. They couldn't change one thing. What was it? Could not change their heart. Why? First part of verse 8. What'd they do? They made up their mind. They purposed their heart. And a child of God, whether it's in the days of the law or it's in the days of the gospel of Christ, if a child of God makes up his mind or makes up her mind, what can the world do to you? What's the worst thing they can do to you? Kill you. That's it. That's all they can do. And that only once. They can't kill you twice. I mean, what, dead? That's it. That's the worst they can do to you. Jesus said, do not fear them that can kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. But rather fear Him who can destroy both body and soul in hell. So these four young men, I think they stand as a great example. They would not allow their hearts to be changed. They made it up. They were convinced that this is what I need to do to be faithful to God. All right. Romans 12, 1 and 2, off-quoted passages. Not being conformed, but being transformed by the renewing of your minds, Paul said. And that's what we need to do, just like Daniel and these three Hebrews did. Look at what can be accomplished when a child of God makes up his mind. You can do a lot. You really can. But that's the first step. You must do that. Determine that you're going to serve God. All right. Anything else through chapter 1 or through the bottom of page 41 that anybody has? Comment or question? Yes, Norm. Absolutely. And the schools are not through with that. In fact, it's probably gotten even more aggressive in teaching children the godless theory of evolution and other educational attempts in the school's system, the redefining of the family, same-sex marriages, all these things, just an attempt to drive more of the world's culture down the throats of people to get them to accept it. That's not going to stop. That's just going to get worse. It's going to wax worse and worse, the Bible says, godliness or ungodliness. I'm not sure I say that right. But we can make up our minds that we're going to do the will of God anyway. So that's a good parallel. Any other comments or questions anybody has? Okay, turn now to page 42, and let's go to chapter 3 now. We're going to skip chapter 2. I know chapter 2 is a great chapter, great story. But we're going to focus on chapter 3, which is the story of these three. Daniel is not involved in this. Some preliminary things to notice. How much time had passed since Daniel 1? Well, we don't know precisely how much time had passed. I think we can say a few things. Number one, we're going to assume that the events that took place in chapter 1 were Nebuchadnezzar's first year. That's when he received the throne. He had rushed back from that battle of defeating the Egyptians at Carchemish to claim the throne of his father who had just died. And he took those captives with him. namely these four we've been talking about. And that was in his first year. Chapter 2 of Daniel, look at the first verse, even though we're going to skip that chapter, but chapter 2 and verse 1 says that those events happened in his second year. The dream of the statue and Daniel's interpretation of the dream and all that. All right? We also notice this. The Septuagint says that the events of Daniel 3, of course, that's the Greek translation of the Old Testament Hebrew Scripture. But it says that this took place in Nebuchadnezzar's 18th year. Now, your version may not say that. Most of the modern versions do not say that. It just doesn't give a time element in chapter 3 and verse 1, even though the Septuagint does. But that cannot be positively proven. There's arguments for and against that statement, so we're not going to get into that, but I thought I'd just at least share that with you. It's possible, but there's no way for the Bible to actually tell us definitively that's what took place. But what we can say this. Chapter 3 does take place after chapter 2. We know that because look at chapter 2 and verse 49. Again, even though we skipped that chapter. After Daniel is through with Nebuchadnezzar and interpreting his dream and everything, and Nebuchadnezzar is heaping all this praise upon Daniel's God. That's verse 47 and 48. Daniel made a request of the king. Chapter 2, verse 49. What did he ask the king? Yeah, my friends here, how about you be thoughtful of them and promote them? And he did. Now look in chapter 3 and verse 12, the chapter we are going to study. When the image decree has been set up, and they're not bowing down to it, the Chaldean officials come and they kind of tattletale on these three Hebrews. What do they mention in chapter 3 and verse 12? See, they mention that promotion. Remember, you put them over some of these provinces. And we're telling you, they're not playing along like everybody else. So we do know that it does take place after chapter 2. We just don't know for sure exactly how long, or even from chapter 1. Because we're connecting chapter 1 with chapter 3 in terms of these three having a made-up mind to serve God. Now we'll see another example of how they made up their minds to serve Jehovah in this instance. Also, and this is just food for thought, why do you think the main reason was that these four or these other officials complained or told Nebuchadnezzar about the refusal of these three to worship the image? Think there's some envy involved? Well, it wouldn't surprise me. The Bible doesn't say they did it because of envy or jealousy, but I think it would not be a stretch of the imagination to think that. Here were these outsiders brought in, and he made them over us, and they're not going to bow down to this image, and so maybe if we get them in trouble and get the heads lopped off, maybe we can get back to where we get some of the honor and the reward, if you will. So I just threw that in there just as food for thought. All right. As this chapter begins, another decree is given. There was a decree given in chapter 1 about the eating of the training, if you will, to make him Chaldean. The decree in this chapter had to do with what? What did the royal order concern? You're off quiet this morning. Yeah, it's the worship of an idol. Really, what it is. It's a great big idol. How tall was Nebuchadnezzar's image? 60 cubits or 90 feet? I mean, that's a tall thing. 90 feet tall. Set up on a platform or a podium, if you will, prominent place. And the decree was, he had all the officials assembled there in verse 2. And says, now when you hear the instruments play, you'll see that in verse 5. At the appointed time, the moment when you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, the trigon, the psaltery, the bagpipe, and all kinds of music. There's supposed to be some little tune played, some little song played. And when you hear that, that's your cue to do what? I want you on your face. I want you bowing down to this image. This is the state religion of Babylon. And you all get in line, and everybody do it. And so the music played, and what happened? Did everybody get in line? Well, all the Chaldeans, they got in line. They all did what they're supposed to do, because after all, you want to honor the king. But there was an exception, wasn't there? We see that. That's the purpose of this of this this story. Now, he also said that the consequences for not doing this. Instant death. How would the... What was the means of execution? Cremation. Well, you want to look at it that way. You get thrown into a fiery furnace. A big giant kiln, if you will. Just pitched right in like a piece of wood. Now that's pressure. That's a pressure cooker right there. Okay. Well, that's the decree, and that's easy to understand. There's no doubts about that at all. All right? Pressure from the throne. Well, these three Hebrews are going to be exposed. Our time is up for this morning. We don't have any more time to cover this and not get caught with a complete thought here. So let's just stop right here. This puts us in page 42, question number 6, and Daniel chapter 3, verse 8, for the start of class on Wednesday night. Thank you for your good comments and participation this morning. I appreciate it.